welling forth in the urban elites' demand for democracy. I'm sure there's lots of people who are unhappy, lots of people who think that the government is mired in sludge and would certainly like to be able to express themselves more, but it doesn't seem to be a problem for the government to control these urges, not a significant problem. What I think might be more important, really, is what happens in Thailand. A large part of the urban elite and other urban people in Laos are watching Thai TV, reading Thai publications. Thailand is apparently moving more and more for democracy. I can only wonder what the members of the Politburo thought of the fact that a lot of their population a few months ago was watching the Thai people turn out in Bangkok and basically, you know, overthrow an undemocratic regime. You know, what kind of a lesson the members of the Politburo thought that was for the people of Laos. So it's my guess, and I can only be a guess, is if Thailand keeps marching towards greater and greater democracy, more and more freedom of expression, and certainly they have quite a bit now, the example to Laos will be very persuasive, and the Lao people will be less content, particularly if Thailand couples this greater democracy with continued economic expansion and the betterment of the lives of their people, that those examples will be very persuasive to a lot of people in Laos, and I suspect would move Laos a lot farther along the road to democracy and pluralism than jawboning by the American ambassador or threats from the German ambassador about what aid they'll get and that sort of thing. It might, you know, over time really constitute a sea change in their attitude. American-Lao relations are never going to be obviously that important for the United States. We're separated by a great distance. Our trade, certainly for the United States, will never be that important. As I mentioned before, we are interested in the prisoner of war missing in action issue. It's certainly my hope and prayer that that will be resolved at least in the next few years. The Lao are cooperating more and more. They never seem to be able to cooperate as much as we would like them to, but perhaps that's inevitable. The Lao are certainly interested in increased trade with the United States. That's predicated on having a trade agreement on according Laos' most favored nation trade status. The two countries are taking the first kind of hesitant steps in that direction, and I hope it'll go forward. Laos can, certainly in Lao terms, I think, make significant exports to the United States because of the cheapness of labor there in certain products. So there is a chance for some trade. It's never going to be that great. It's certainly not going to be the most important trade for Laos. Thailand and other countries in the area will be much more important than the United States, but nevertheless, it'll be useful. There is also, of course, the question of the Lao-American community. We have here in the United States now several hundred thousand people who see their roots in Laos, are very concerned about what happens in Laos, as I think some of the questions reflected earlier today. They have differing attitudes about what should be done. And I think that their attitudes, what they do, how they react to what's going on in Laos will have an important effect on the evolution of Lao-American relations, and I think that's proper. One problem for Laos as it moves forward is the whole need for international aid. It would like to have aid from the United States. We're prevented by law at the moment from doing what we might call a regular aid program. We do give them some assistance in the form of emergency food and some other humanitarian gestures, but a regular aid program is not possible at the moment. I hope it'll be possible in the near future. I think Laos is going to have a problem. It really needs international aid in order to balance its accounts and make the kind of expansion that it would like, and it's going to be competing. I mean, you just have to look around the world. All the countries that are in great urgency really need aid at this moment. All the calls on the purse of Japan and the West, the United States, I think Laos is going to have a very hard time competing with that. I mean, Laos is not an emergency. It's doing okay. There's lots of other places where you have to say that they need it right now, and they need it in the worst way. So I think Cambodia, if things work out, will be a place where lots of people will want to put some of their assistance. It'll be much more dramatic than than what is going on in Laos. So I think it's going to be hard for the Lao to increase the amount of international aid they have, however well they manage their affairs or however ill they do it, and they will have difficulty in that regard. The Lao economy, I guess Laos is a lot like these kind of 19-year-old fellows that appear in Florida during the spring training in baseball every year. They have a lot of potential, and somebody says there's nothing greater curse than a lot of potential. Laos has the potential of great mineral potential. When I was out there the last time, a geologist was just kind of aglow about all the ore and iron and gold and other things that might be found in Laos. Some people think that Laos might be the kind of Saudi Arabia of hydroelectricity. It has so much potential there. Obviously, they have to sell to the Thai. But all of these things take a tremendous amount of investment, a tremendous amount of infrastructure building. But the potential is there. Laos is, there are a lot of countries of the world in which you look at them and you say, even if these people were run by, the philosopher kings of the Plato talks about, they really couldn't do very much. Well, Laos is a country that could do pretty well, quite well. The potential is there. It isn't condemned to being abjectly poor forever. One of the things they're working on, is opening up the road system of the country. And they've been getting assistance from quite a number of countries, including Vietnam, to do that. One big step forward is the bridge. It's just the bridge. There are no other bridges. This would be the first one across the Mekong anywhere, as far as I know, connecting Ta Dua with Nong Khai. And there's even talk of extending the railroad across that bridge. I think that it's hard to know how, Laos, in a sense, has been kind of an island all this time. If those of you who've traveled up there, particularly by land, getting there was really kind of an adventure. Once that bridge is connects Laos with Thailand, with the road system, with the railroad system, I think that it has the potential to make profound changes. And the leadership in Vientiane, I think, has the same view. And it both heartens them and worries them because they see the great economic potential of being connected more closely to Thailand. And they also see and they fear the ideas, which I think are getting there anyway through television and radio and books and everything else, but the ideas that would flow out of Thailand of the we might call the greater world that could be a threat to their hold on power. So I think that's all I have to say about Laos's likeliest road, and I'll be glad to take questions later on.
Thank you very much. And finally, we come to U.S. Diplomacy. Fred Brown, I guess this is what last and least, or from the sublime to the ridiculous.
Right.
No,
it's from the ridiculous to the sublime.
Anyway, it's all yours, Fred.
Thanks. I have 8 minutes. Mm-hmm. I'll spend 2 or 3 minutes on Cambodia and 5 minutes on Vietnam. With regard to Cambodia, Kataria has given us a very deep view of the great problems facing a post-UNTAC Cambodia. Let me say, in terms of U.S. policy, it strikes me that there are several things that will face our mission in Phnom Penh very rapidly and the State Department. First, obviously, is the conduct of the election. The United States, along with the rest of the Perm 5 and the core group countries involved in the Cambodia settlement, are going to have to make a judgment on the credibility of the electoral process, not only the election itself, which will take a week or two, but also the constitution writing procedure and then the formation of the government and then, Lord knows, whatever role Sihanouk plays. I would suspect the United States will play a lead role in the deliberations on the credibility of that process, just as it has all during the conduct of the UNTAC period and indeed in the writing of the Paris agreements from beginning really in 1989 through October 91. So this is a big load on the shoulders of Washington. There are going to be some very important judgments made. Part of that judgment will be with regard to the nature of the leadership that emerges. I remember 2 years ago, Hun Sen was routinely labeled a puppet of the Vietnamese. All of a sudden, about last year, American officials began to talk about what would happen if Hun Sen died or were assassinated. That would be a crisis for American policy. Well, we're going to have decisions or judgments of that sort that will come up very quickly during the summer. We didn't talk, either Qatari or I, did not talk about the likely composition of a government after the election. In my view, it will be very unlikely that one single party, Phung Sinh Pek or the CPP, let's say they're the most likely, will get more than 60 votes out of 120 as a result of this election. Most likely, it strikes me that the plurality party will get somewhere in the 50s, and the next party, be it the CPP or the Phung Sinh Pek, will get in the 40s or low 50s. In any event, you're going to have a coalition government, almost inevitably, in my view, coming out of this election, which means there's going to have to be a great deal of tolerance shown between the leaderships of the two or three ranking parties. The Liberal Democratic Buddhist Party and the LDP, the Buddhist Democratic Liberal Party and the LDP may play very interesting roles as getting somewhere between 5 and 15 or 20 votes each. They may be the swing parties in this arrangement. But Washington will be making some very critical choices here. In my view, there is no sense, no productive reason for us as observers to sit around and lambaste UNTAC or the UN for all the failures and weaknesses that have been part of the Paris arrangement, the falseness of the idea of comprehensiveness in the agreement, etc. A lot is being written now in the media, which I think is very harmful to whatever hope is left for some kind of stability in Cambodia. So I would just say that we have to keep faith with the process as it has brought us to this point, and that the United States policy must be based very firmly on accord and agreement, first of all among the PERM 5, and second of all among the whole core group at the UN. This is the only way that there's going to be any kind of peace or stability in Cambodia.
Thank you. Time for coffee. Jack Schellenberger? Jack Schellenberger, are you here? Jack Schellenberger? I guess he's gone.
I'm Some of those questions you may already address. out there on the table.
Yeah. Right, right. Well, there'd be a lot of policy decisions for the Vietnamese to make, too.
Pardon?
There'd be a lot of policy thinking for the Vietnamese to make, too, with respect to their this triangular relation of us, China, and ASEAN. You know, they sort of coasting, but they're going to have to make some choices between the U.S. and China, for example, which will not be all that easy.
Our audience has been thinned out by circumstance.
Yes.
Even Dottie, who I counted on to ask me a zinger,
wind up talking to ourselves.
Well, we'll keep this quite short, I think. I'm not going to make any concluding remarks.
I made it in 9 minutes, Mr. Douglas.
Yes.
I thought tonight was pretty well.
All right, shall we reconvene, ladies and gentlemen? I'd like to call to your attention a paper back there. I think there's still some left, called U.S. Policy Toward Vietnam, the Economic Dimension. This is by, is it by Fred Brown?
Yeah.
By Fred Brown. We'll be happy to autograph copies on your way out. All right, who would like to ask a question or make a comment?
You didn't get all the speakers back yet.
Yes, well, we're all waiting for the... You can ask this of the speakers that have already returned. I'll answer for both of us. So.
We all know that Vietnamese leaders are very old, and in the 70s. How can you see the situation in Vietnam after they are gone?
I don't know whether I should answer this before Hung gets back. Here he comes. I'll answer. I won't tell you what the question is. Well, I think the real question is what kind of leaders are going to be thrown forward. And the real problem in Vietnam was it had a North Vietnam, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, had a really a first-rate leadership group during the war. For their needs and their objectives, it was as good as any leadership group in the world. The trouble is, it was exactly the wrong kind of leadership for peacetime. And it has taken them a long time, I think, even to recognize that simple fact. But I feel that what has happened in, I think where Hung and I disagree somewhat, is I think there has been much more forward thinking and rational thinking and intelligent thinking in Hanoi than we tend to give them credit for. I think they recognize now that there is a change, that they must abolish the economic system they did have, and they have. I think this is irreversible. And I think they also know that the Leninist system has got to go. And the whole name of the game now is how to arrange this so that you do not get Bataan, or instability, as they say. I think there's universal agreement in Vietnam. Nobody wants that. I mean, even among the most avid reformers in the South. So how to transfer the economic or the political scene to a multi-party system or a political pluralism, or what I would tend to regard as soft authoritarian government, the kind that you now have in Taiwan and Korea and Singapore. Well, it's not so soft in Singapore, maybe. I guess we've got a Singapore embassy representative here who carefully taking notes on what I say. Anyway, a recognition that it is in the national interest to create a softer kind of leadership, which is not democratic as we think of it. But what impresses me about the Vietnamese in Hanoi now is the consciousness of the need for this change. And they aren't just a bunch of tired old hangers-on anymore. Most of these jungle fighters are gone now. And what you've got is a transitional group that are not particularly impressive, although some of them are. I think there's a couple of people in the Politburo that are very impressive. And it's around these people, I think, that the new generation of leadership is going to be built. But this is always very uncertain and indeterminate. Look at our leadership in this country since Jimmy Carter and on, I'd say. Unpredictable.
Could I make
it? He asked Hung to...
Okay. What's the question?
I know. You have to guess what it is. What about future leadership?
I don't think... Scott, I don't think you and I disagree on the Vietnamese leadership. I think they're very rational. Now, the way they calculate is very rational. They know Leninism have to go. They know Marxism is discredited. The key question is their position, their power position, for the group and for themselves. So the question, they're very rational. They can't go to democracy now, pluralism, because it's dangerous. And there are lots of things. They wanted to build up economic development first, like you said, to have some credibility. The legitimacy for fighting the war is gone. It's over now. So they need some other form of legitimacy. I'm thinking of something like, Khrushchev destabilization campaign. He want to build on some kind of achievement rather than on terror. So in their way of thinking, they're rational. The difficulty is how to get out of it, without losing face and without really losing power and without endangering their position. So in that way, I think you and I, in a sense, not disagreeable, and we do not disagree. Now the question about where the new leadership is coming from, I think at the present time there seems to be a balance between the group that want to look forward economically. I think everyone in Vietnam, including Lady Anh, want economic development. The question is the emphasis of concern. Those people who are concerned about security are the security people, and it's only logical. People like Vo Văn Kiệt, Phan Văn Khải, who are not interested in that, would worry about economics. But the fact is that the establishment of national defense security, I think, is in a way respond to events that are happening in 1989, like at Tiananmen Square. It is Military Affairs Commission of the CC, Central Committee, that make decision. So now, when you establish that kind of legitimate form, where you have three generals on there, they are going to make decisions as far as that happen, if something happens. So they do prepare for that. They make logical preparation for that kind of thing. So we have a tug of war between these two. But I see in the future, as economic development begin to do what, many of those children of those leaders now are moving out into the economic sphere rather than in the politics. They are the one who's going to make change. Inevitably, that kind of leadership. That does not preclude the fact that someone in the Politburo now, at some time, may think in need of a change, because the Vietnamese always pay attention to what's happening around them. What happened in China would have repercussions on them. What happened in the Soviet Union have repercussions on them. So whatever is going to happen outside will have impact upon them. So the sources of change I would see coming from numbers of people. One is from the people who come back from Eastern European countries. Two are from the sons and daughters or the leaderships who are now moving into economic position. They feel secure, they have a transferable skill for new society, and they don't have any hang-up with Marxism, Leninism. And number three, I think the interaction between them and the outside world, people who go to Harvard, going to go size, to go to your place to study. I think the interaction between that and the Vietnamese expatriate is going to be sources of change in Vietnam.
Do you want to add something to this?
Yeah. I think about Korea and I think about Taiwan. In both those cases,
there were authoritarian governments, and they weren't very soft either.
No, they were
For roughly a quarter of a century before pluralism began to emerge. And in both those cases, I think it was the fact that the economic policies that were being formed, were being followed, were quite successful. Economic progress was taking place, so that you were always able to hold off the more democratic pressures. And I think that might be the case in Vietnam.
Yeah, I just want to add one thing. What we were told in Hanoi, in effect, to truncate what was said, was we are a hard authoritarian society. We are going to move toward a soft authoritarian society, and we're going to do it through the mechanism of economic development. And we think we can do this in about 5 years. It's a moot question whether they can do this as easily or as handily, systematically. It's the same thing Ceausescu thought and Honecker thought too, but it didn't work. It blew up. So there's still that possibility. But I'm firmly convinced that the leadership in Hanoi today is a very intelligent, aware, and fast-moving leadership. And they're not a bunch of dummies, and they're not a bunch of anachronisms, and they're no longer a bunch of simply skilled jungle fighters. What they lack really is the technology of management, how to run governments. It's not easy to run a government. You might know if you work in one.
May I add a perspective on this?
Yes, go ahead.
For 30 seconds. I heard one explanation of how the leadership is going to move or be recreated in Vietnam from a relatively high-ranking Vietnamese cadre who said that within 5 years, the leadership in Vietnam will be contained within about 500 families, brothers, sisters, children, etc., visions of Suharto, and that these will be families drawn primarily from the current Communist Party nomenclatura, except they won't be called communists anymore. But there will be a friendly association of, call it 400 or 600 families, that will basically dominate Vietnamese economic and then political life.
It's an interesting model. Yes. Kim Il-sung.
Sally from the Laos Service, VOA. I listed several things that I think it could be factors to press for changes. I underline the word press because for the lack of word, and you can substitute it if you can find a better word. To press change, to welcome democracy or pluralism to Laos. And these are veteran jungle fighters, younger generation educated in the Eastern Europe or Western world, influence from Thailand, books, television, and so on, needs for change for economic changes. And last but not least, VOA, Laos Service. And I hope that would last. And I don't know how long these veteran jungle fighters are going to resist these factors. I'd like your comment on this, Mr. Johnson.
Well, I think, and I apologize for neglecting the VOA when I mentioned the influences that would affect people. Though I hate to say this about radio and television. I mean, television is an awful, kind of all-encompassing and persuasive instrument. Even when it doesn't try to persuade. But all those things are happening, but the present leadership is not facing in demonstrations or unrest, or there's no stirrings in Savannah Khet against them. There's the students at Don Duc are not planning marches on the Central Committee headquarters. There's I think that all these things are working, but they're working slowly, and that there's going to be an evolution. And the present leadership may, have gone to the great Central Committee in the sky, long before they in fact change, force them to make fundamental changes. But I think the fundamental changes are coming because of all these factors, and we might just say the modern world, as Laos increasingly, because of what it's trying to, what the present leadership is doing in terms of opening up the country, of wanting more people to come in, of wanting investment, of wanting to have an educated population, of wanting to educate in an elite way their own children. All of these things over time will change what's happening in Laos and the way people look at politics. But I don't think that General Kamtai Sipindon has to, when he goes to sleep at night, really worry that the mob is going to march on him, or that the other members of the Politburo or the Central Committee are going to try to oust him.
Bob?
Doug Pike, I was intrigued by your statement of what you were told by the leadership in Hanoi, that in 5 years there would be a transition to a softer authoritarian rule. What lessons did these people draw from Tiananmen Square?
Well, I think they draw the lesson that's not going to happen here, that the Chinese let things get out of control, that what they did finally in crushing it, they had to do, but the great mistake was allowing it to get that far. And they, the Vietnamese, are smarter than that, would never allow it to happen. It's very hard to, of course, to go into a country and take the temperature for revolution. Are these people getting ready to revolt or aren't they? But I can find no evidence of this. I think that there is, the present leadership has sold the people of Vietnam on the idea that you're going to get richer and richer every year, and eventually you're going to get not democracy as we know it in the West, which is an alien notion throughout Asia, including Cambodia, I would say, but the concept of a representative government. What you really want, I think, in government is justice, not democracy. You want a system that provides justice. And if the prospect is that you are going to get that, first you're going to get rich or richer, and then you're going to get justice, people will put up with an awful lot of nonsense day to day in what the government does. But you still have to deliver. I'll tell you what the really disturbing rumor, which we heard frequently in Vietnam, was that they have given the party 5 years to get their act together. And if they don't get their act together, they are going to get rid of them. And you say, who is this they? And the military? Well, not really the military or the police. It's just they. And you don't know whether this is a kind of wish or a hope, but it's a kind of ubiquitous report that the party has a gun at its head, and it is a sense of the party people themselves. Often we'll say, yes, we've got 5 years in which to really turn this thing around, get our act together. I don't know where this 5 years came from, but that was last year, so now it's 4 years that they've got to. But it's a very genuine sense among the Vietnamese. It's one of these social consensus things. What we all agree with in Vietnam is we've got 4 years to get this place turned around. They don't agree yet on the second part of social consensus, is what it is that you're going to turn around to, exactly.
Could I comment?
Yes.
What I'd like to. Hello. Yeah, I'd like to come back to what Bill Sharp was saying about democracy, prospect for democracy in Vietnam, and the prospect of having an authoritarian society, political authoritarian regime that bring about economic developments. I think that has been a stereotype discussions, and it's very effective use in 1960, but today it's not 1960. The world is not bipolarized. There's nobody who's, American or other country are not going to put up with that kind of authoritarianism. And number two, there is an age of the fax machine, the television. What happened in South Asia is going to have a lot of impact on Vietnam. Vietnam has a number of things. Number one, it's a late developer. Number two, it's a late convert. It have to accept the pressure from all around the world. They already have decided to open up. So that penetration is going to come in from the West. Penetration is going to come in from Southeast Asia. Penetration is coming from the people who graduate from Eastern European countries that's going through the 89 period, 90 period. And the problem is with the South Vietnamese, the majority. So all the thing is not make Vietnam completely different cases than the case of Taiwan in the 1950s, South Korea 1960, Thailand 1958. It's completely different. So I think you know, the context is different. It is difficult for the Vietnamese to continue an authoritarian regime for a very long time. And especially now that it seems to me, and I agree with some of the people who say here that communism is dead in Vietnam, especially among the son and daughters of the cadre. They don't care about that anymore.
I think, if anything, from Tiananmen, one thing that we can learn is that when we speak about liberalization, we need to still make the distinction between economic and political liberalization, and that with all of these systems and societies, we can discuss market orientation, we can discuss about economic reforms, but all of that stops short of political kind of openness and a more encompassing or pluralistic model of the political system. And so that's one thing. But perhaps in the case of the difference between China and Vietnam is that China, as has already been said earlier, may be in a position of greater leverage that allows it to disregard some of the international pressure, perhaps, or the pressure of the greater powers, whereas in Vietnam, without that kind of strategic leverage, that it may have to be much more sensitive to the environment, the regional environment particularly. So that's just something to be noted. And the second point is that when we talk about the death of Marxism and Leninism, we still have to contend with the fact that behind this facade, the ideological veneer, there's also just a simple fact of traditional despotism, right? And I think that when you remove the ideological rhetoric, what may remain is still authoritarianism in a traditional sense. And that's still something that needs to be worked upon.
I talked more in Saigon, I would say, than in I mean, everybody at Hanoi University is a reformer. In fact, the problem is when you go to Hanoi, you don't meet the conservatives. You don't meet the old hardliners. And they're still there, but they have nothing to say to foreigners, and so you can tend to get a misreading as to how ubiquitous really is this sense of reform. But I think from top to bottom, from Politburo to the rice field, there's simply this dissatisfaction with the way things have been. Nobody defends the status quo. Nobody, I'd say, in Vietnam says it should. The next 10 years should be the way the last 15 years have been. So there is that much consensus, the need for change. That's, I think, as far as it's gone. But that's quite a turnaround, actually. I mean, there's no forces there that defend the status quo, really. They aren't there in the military, aren't there in the police, in the coercive elements. They may still be there in Ho Chi Minh, the party school. In the Minh Ai Quoc Institute. But you don't even find this in the theoretical journals, hardly. We've talked about this earlier. It's almost the overnight death of ideology as a respectable intellectual concept, and nobody defends it anymore. Nobody even tries to defend it, and so you're left with the question: were they ever ideological? I, for years, of course, thought that's what drove that system in the North, and now you go and you can't find evidence of it even having ever existed, really. Except in the old journals and so on. So, again, we're talking about, and of course, I'm being hit by my students who say, well, what you're saying about communism in Vietnam is not what you wrote about communism 20 years ago. And they start quoting my books, and so I fall back on this quote from Confucius, I wish I knew it in Chinese because it sounds much better. Who is, the students put the same thing to him, Master, when you are now 70 years old and you're saying this, but when you were 27 you said this, how do you account for that? And it's this famous statement in Chinese, and it says, that was then and this is now. Yes.
In Cambodia? Oh,
well, I think if I can identify now, they're probably in jail. So nobody knows. If you talk about radical transformation, you don't. But if you talk about those guys who have talked about it, who still survive, then you have numbers of names. You got, as a matter of fact, own communist. I mean, high official talk about the need for political reform. The deputy director of the Marxism-Leninism Institute talk about political reform. And Li Bang the other day talk about political reform, but of course their own way. So they own talk about political reform. So you talk about reformer, you got that. Now the famous name that was identified in the West was Nguyễn Văn Linh, Võ Văn Kiệt, Phan Văn Khải. They seen one. Hardliner tend to be Lê Khả Phiêu, Lê Đức Anh, Đoàn Khuê. So you have that dichotomy. And then you have talk about dissidents. You have Chen Xuân Bách, who said who say something about multi-party system. And then he was sacked from the Politburo, but he's still alive. We have Phan Đình Diệu, the vice president of the Vietnamese Academy of Social Science, who talk about also about political pluralism. He's still around, still operated, still go around. He's not a political threat, though, so he's tolerated. So these are the people who talk about Hoàng Minh Chính even, talk about, you know, he said that nobody knows what Marxism-Leninism is about. So his petitions are circulated within the party, seem to say that let's have a pause on the application of Marxism-Leninism until we know what it's all about. So if you want names who are survived, that's the names. But if you ask of those people who are going to make change, I just don't know. You have to go, you know, you have to come from the dark.
I think the intention is to have the military and the security engineer this political change. General An and the foreign minister of security, Ngo. They're the two, and they're both, I think, are a fairly smart team. The trouble is that they're old, and they another 5 years, I don't know where they can...
72.
Yeah. Ngo is younger than this. I think he's. He's the guy that went to the. This is the story you're getting. I don't know if it's true or not. The Minister of Security at the KGB in Moscow have two schools for foreign students. One is for students for the son of some foreign. Minister of some country who wants to get his idiot nephew out of town, and so they send him to KGB school in Moscow, and they get a few field trips and a nice diploma, and so then they have another school which is for serious KGB people, and that Ngo is the only Vietnamese that ever went through this school, and one of the few foreigner students that ever went through, I mean a fairly small group, and he's a comer. I think he's the guy to watch. I'm also told that he is not not your usual jackboot type security fellow that a Vietnamese I know that talked to him as a relative. That's how he happened to told him that that he was not concerned about internal security. We don't worry about these dissident poets, as he put it. What we worry about is China. That's what we worry about. And that, to me, is a kind of professional security type thinking. And the kind, what was the one Andropov in the Soviet Union, a security man that they thought one might try to move the country toward the liberal, more liberal policies. There was a question back here, yes.
Oh, when Dr. Manhung mentioned about the Vietnamese constitution said about protecting the Vietnamese in Cambodia, it reminded me that during the recent Congress party, Le Duc An saying the same thing. He says that he got to protect the ethnic cleansing. To me, this is a clear signal that Vietnamese might come back in some days. For the there's a problems already that the Cambodian can see in the future that the Vietnamese communists are going to come back because the polluted atmosphere in Cambodia is, how can you stabilize this kind of polluted atmosphere where Cambodian people are fearful of the Vietnamese, whether minority and or majority? The question is, who's cleansing who? With this kind of problems, I think the U.S. policy toward Cambodia is kind of unclear. Cambodia has been in the sideshow since Vietnam War, and it is kind of sideshow now and probably continue in the future. So I'm kind of worried what's going to happen in the future when Vietnam invade Cambodia again. I believe this is something that Vietnam is still watching Bosnia, where the Americans still keep their hands off without interventions. Maybe when Vietnam invaded Cambodia, the Americans can continue to embargo, but will the Japanese will do the same, or will the Singaporean or the French will do the same? That's still a question. I believe that to prevent another bloodshed, U.S. should have a real strong policy, maybe a clear policy now. Thank you.
Could I correct myself?
Yes.
Well, basically, I didn't say that the Vietnamese constitution mentioned anything like, you know, protection of ethnic, Vietnamese ethnic. The Vietnamese constitution doesn't say that. I only quote, it say that they dropped the mention to close total collaboration with the Soviet Union, Cambodia, and Laos. The fact that before they already consider that's very important, strategic solidarity. What that means is they have already reoriented their foreign policy toward the Western world. And as far as the possibility of the Vietnamese coming back to Cambodia, I think the possibility is probably, to me, in the next few years, is nil, nothing. The Vietnamese neither have the heart nor the capability to do so, nor the consensus at home to do so. Vietnam after Cambodia, just like American right after Vietnam, they are not going to come back, can't come back.
I might just mention, as far as there's kind of two kinds of, we talk about the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia, and we kind of talk about two different things. One, of course, is the military invasion, which I think correctly is not going to happen. The other is what Cambodians perceive as this kind of movement, tidal-like movement of Vietnamese people into Cambodia for one reason or another. No one knows how many there are, but Cambodians think that apparently there are too many. But I think fundamentally this is a question which a future government of Cambodia is going to have to face. The Cambodians will have to decide about what they're going to do. They're obviously going to, they should do that within the, you know, within the boundaries of humanitarian behavior. But it's Cambodia and Vietnam that'll have to work out that problem. And not the United States, and not Thailand, and not Singapore, but a future government in Phnom Penh.
What those of you who, I'm not speaking either to the Vietnamese or Khmer now, but I'm speaking to the rest of you, what you should take away from this exchange, and you've heard this afternoon, is a very firm conviction as just how deep and ingrained is this ethnic antipathy between Vietnamese and Cambodians. We tend to try to sweep it under the rug in the name of unity and peace, but it's one of the great antipathies of the world. It's right up there with Greek, Turkish, Arab, Jew, Muslim, Hindu, what are some of the others? Just as well entrenched, just as irrational, and just as resistant to advice from outsiders. In all cases of these antipathies, I think all of us have said to people of the one side or the other, this is madness, your attitude, you're hurting yourself. And they say, well, you say that because you're not one of us. If you were one of us, you wouldn't say that. But you're not, and so you never can understand how it is. And it defies outside advice, and the best that we outsiders can do is simply be aware of this problem, how deeply ingrained it is, how well entrenched it is, and how the best that we can do is to try to avoid exacerbating the relationship and doing whatever little things we can do to ameliorate it. But it's there all the time, and it's a major fact of life, and it's going to remain the central fact of life in Indochina in the years to come.
No, I do agree with everything you just said. I just want to add something that, you know, for the future government of Cambodia, and of course that depends on the complexion and the constitution of that government, but nonetheless there are certain fundamental issues that will have to be re-examined, and one of it is, of course, immigration issue would be one. Another very potentially sensitive issue would be treaties that have been signed and concessions that have been made by various, you know, particularly with the Hun Sen regime, with Vietnam and Thailand, but also concessions that have been struck between various factions, informally or otherwise. Those issues will have to be come up for future discussion. I think Sihanouk has already mentioned that, you know, he will take a lead on some of those issues if and when he becomes comes in charge of the government. So that's an area to watch.
Nithiyama Pingpong from the Thai Service. I'm just curious about these three Indochina countries. What do you see their role or their needs and their wants, and what do they expect from ASEAN countries, if there should be any? I'm not talking about only Thailand, ASEAN as a whole. You talk in passing that Vietnam would like to be a member of ASEAN. Would ASEAN want Vietnam in? What would be the implication? What would be the easiest way to integrate Vietnam in? If somebody could help laying along the map along that line. Thank you.
Political or economic?
Well, on the purely economic side, I